I think it's important that you earn your stripes in the industry, that you understand the nuances so that the knowledge gap that we say is there isn't there. So I would say that try and work somewhere before you go try to start your own company or raise some money. I wasn't prepared for how long it would take and how difficult it would be. You read TechCrunch, I say, everybody's like raising millions. This must be so easy. You know, if there's one thing anybody listening to this and take away is that raising VC is very difficult. It will take you a long, long time to do it. Patient capital is really important. What that means is that you gotta be so impatient for returns, but impatient for progress. And the reason for that is that we are doing very foundational stuff. A lot of us are building infrastructure, and it takes time to build infrastructure.
My guest for today is Ibeme Neto, a medical doctor and the founder and CEO of Wella Health. I've been following Neto on Twitter for more than a year, and his insights on building a startup in Nigeria are quite refreshing, so it was only a matter of time before I had him on as a guest. On this episode, our conversation revolves around how training as a medical doctor influences him today. He also shares his opinion on how startup founders should approach venture capital, as well as thoughts on getting academia to work with business. This was my best conversation in a while, and I'm sure it would be the same for you. So thank you so much for taking out the time to do this. I'm pretty sure you both have a lot of other things that you're doing, but thank you so much for taking out the time.
Thanks, my pleasure.
So let's get to know you. How would you describe yourself? So outside your job, how would you describe yourself?
That's a great question. Outside my job, how would I describe myself? I think some people say I'm very serious. So I do a lot of serious things and think very seriously about a lot of things and concern myself with the kind of nitty-gritty and intricacies of very deep questions. So in many respects, I'm very serious. But on the flip side, I'm also very fun. So I love to dance. And so I would say that I'm a bit like a coin. And on one side, very serious. On the other side, I can be quite fun. So that's my off the top of my head response.
Okay. So where did you pick up dancing? Because I've seen a couple of your Instagram videos where you're doing, I think it's salsa practice. So when did you pick up dancing?
That's right. Yeah. So I dance a number of Latin dances, salsa being one of them, kizomba. So I picked that up when I was in university, actually. It was a serendipitous story, and it's one of the things, experiences in life, that has led me to realize that it's important to always give yourself the opportunity to have new experiences and always be open to new experiences. And so I just dropped in to help out somebody, and it turned out they were teaching a class and I was really good at dancing. And so one thing led to another, and I've been dancing for over 10 years now, and it turns out I'm actually pretty good at it.
All right. So you're a medical doctor, or you trained to be a medical doctor, and now you're the founder of a health tech startup. Was starting a business always in the plan, or was it just something you started all of a sudden?
No, it wasn't always in the plan. I mean, if I'd projected my career sort of when I was in medical school, if I projected it forwards, I would never have thought I'd start a business. And so it was kind of something that just happened because I wanted to solve a problem that was very personal to me and that I was passionate about. And it became obvious very quickly that starting a business was the best way to solve that problem. I'd gone through the matrix of things you can do. And I figured out that actually the best way to do it was to start a business. And I'm actually coming to a point where I'm evolving past even that and thinking that maybe there is even better ways to solve the problems that I'm passionate about. There are better ways to do it beyond just entrepreneurship.
Okay. So just before we go ahead, can you explain what problem was this that you wanted to solve, and how did it lead to what you do today at Wella Health?
Yeah, so it was poor healthcare access, you know, and really poor quality healthcare, you know. So I trained as a physician, and I mean, I was the cliche doctor in that, I studied doctor for the cliched reason of I wanted to help people. At least that's what I'm told from when I was really young. I always wanted to be a doctor to help people. And for some reason, I wanted to help the most number of people possible. So I always felt like I needed to impact people on a large scale. So my impact when I finish my career is in the order of hundreds of thousands or millions. I kind of had that inborn desire early on. And I very quickly realized that sitting in a clinic every day wouldn't get me there. At best, I'd see a few thousand, maybe 10,000 patients. But I really wanted to make an impact on a large scale. Also, considering that in Nigeria, there's a lot of healthcare challenges, there's a huge healthcare gap. And I knew that, you know, to affect the most people possible would make a huge difference in a way that sitting in a clinic on a day-to-day basis wouldn't. And so that is what really colored the way I looked at my career and my life. And that's what eventually led me to starting a business. Because what better way to affect lots of people than, you know, creating a technology-enabled business that brings healthcare affordably to people.
All right. So your Twitter profile paints the picture of someone that is continuously reading. And you mentioned earlier that a lot of people see you as very serious. I think I'll fall into that category. So how are you able to balance reading a lot of things that may not necessarily be related to what you do as a health tech founder? How are you able to balance that and your job?
Yeah, so one of the advantages of training to be a doctor is that you learn to absorb a lot of information. You know, so, I mean, we would spend 40 hours a week in lectures, and then you'd be expected to study afterwards. Then you qualify, you're working, say, 60-hour weeks, and you're still expected to study for exams. So you get very used to taking in a lot of information as a matter of course. And I think that has stood to me then in actually being a founder, because one of the things as a founder is you have a huge knowledge gap. You have to learn a lot about finance, accounting, HR, product development, design, lots of technical stuff, engineering. So I would say that the best founders are generalists that can absorb a lot of information very quickly. And I find that, I mean, I'm no one to call myself a great founder, but if there's one thing that I do know that I have is I have a lot of knowledge. Now, whether I use it the right way, I don't know, but I definitely have a lot of knowledge. And medicine kind of prepared me for that. And so I'm able to actually, first of all, I have a curiosity that can never be satiated. I'm always interested to know more. And I've been taught as well, you know, going through, you know, a good medical school, how to find that knowledge. A lot of people don't know how to actually search for knowledge, but I'm very good at that. I can read research papers and understand them. I can process data very easily. And so that means that there's always something to read. I'm always reading a book or research reports, boring stuff. Like I said, I'm a serious person. And so I can take in a lot of that data and that knowledge. And that really helps me to refine my guts. And so when I make decisions, a lot of times, because of all the information that I've had, I'm able to make better decisions because I just kind of intuitively have an idea of what is sensible and what isn't.
Okay. So what else about your training as a doctor has helped you in your journey as a founder?
Yeah, I would say kind of that penchant for hard work, you know, just going and working hard. That really stood to me. I would say also, like I said, the knowledge, just being able to take on a lot of knowledge, process data. I would also say that around user research, so being able to speak to people, build a rapport, collect information, you know, that stood very, that was very useful skill to have, especially when I started out. Because in medicine, they teach you about communication skills. You know, you have to build a rapport very quickly. Then you're able to kind of get to the nitty-gritty very quickly, analyze things. And so I think those things were really key. Also, there's a lot of leadership involved in being a doctor. And I think that also helped with when I, you know, founded my startup. I was able to take all of these learnings. And hopefully that's kind of helped me as I've gone along in my journey.
Okay. So these days, when I speak with founders or when I, like, maybe scrolling through Twitter or somewhere, it just looks like a lot of startup founders think that the next logical step after they have an idea, or maybe after they've built out the first version of the product, is to raise money. So when do you think is the right time for a startup to start raising venture capital? And what type of business should be raising venture capital?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it's very specific to the exact instance. I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all answer here, because the response is definitely dependent on the market, the product, the timing, all of these variables. So I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all. What I would say as a rule, and I'm a fan of rules and frameworks, and I share that so that people can apply it in their own instances. The rule that I generally and framework that I subscribe to is that of figuring out as much as you can, you know, yourself on your own before going outside to look for external support. And I mean that to say that you want to make some meaningful progress, because whether it's easy or hard to raise money, what money is looking for, so what venture capital is looking for is a return, right? And so the easier and quicker you can give venture capital that return, then the easier it is on the journey. If you haven't figured out a significant portion of the business before you go to raise venture capital, what you end up doing is using venture capital to figure that out. And venture capital is very expensive, you know? So if you raise it too early, what you do is you lose out on a lot of equity, right? Ownership. And then you give yourself significant pressure that wouldn't be there otherwise. And so one of my leading advice to early stage founders is to bootstrap for as long as they can. Now, of course, that doesn't apply to every idea or every market or every solution. Sometimes you might get a blank check of $10 million to go at it. But even if you do, I would say don't spend that money. Go and figure out the markets. Do customer discovery, build with the market, sell a product, get some revenue. And I would say that will stand to you better in the longer term.
Okay. It appears you have a bias for building a very lean business, not just raising money for money's sake. And Wella Health has also not raised a ton of money since you were founded. Is that the main reason why you haven't raised money? I mean, these days, a few health tech startups are raising money. So what has been your major reason for not raising a lot?
Yes. Yeah, so, I mean, we have raised, you know, venture capital, but our burn is very, I'm an angel investor. And I was looking at some angel reports from some angel syndicates I'm in, and I was flabbergasted at some of the burn that I'm seeing from some companies that are much smaller than us and have much smaller revenue than us. We do six figures ARR in dollars every month, and our burn is less than $20,000. And we have a team that's almost 60 people, right? Mm-hmm. So that gives you a sense of how efficient we've gotten more in revenue than we've raised in venture capital, right? And we're still early. We're not a later stage company. So it gives you a sense of how efficient we are with capital. And my belief is that a lot of VCs will say this to you, like, capital is rocket fuel, right? You should really use rocket fuel when you're sure, like, okay, you're kind of pointing in the right direction, because you don't want to use rocket fuel and end up in the wrong place, you know? So I'm definitely a fan of being very capital efficient. And it's great for everybody involved, because you as a founder, you own more of the company at the end of the day. When you exit, your venture capitalists are invariably happier if you can be more efficient with the resources. So I would definitely, in my experience, say that being more efficient and being prudent with resources is very important, especially now where venture capital is now very difficult to come by. Companies like my company, who have been very careful, I think will be able to see this difficult period through, rather than those that were just raising lots of money for money's sake. And having said that, there's something to be said for that as well, because not everybody wants to build a sustainable business long term. Some people maybe just want to cash out. And I guess that's fair enough too.
Okay, yeah, it's fair enough. So you've mentioned that you've seen a lot of startups who have a higher bond rate, even though they have lower revenues than you. And even though I'm not an investor, I see a few startups who I just assume that there's no way you have a low bond rate. It's just impossible because of some of the activities you're doing, your marketing activities. They just look like they're so elaborate and you're spending a lot of money on them. And it just makes me wonder, is it always a founder's fault, or do investors also have a role to play in how founders just want to burn as much money as they can if it gives them a certain result?
Yes. So yes, but having said that, the story is changing. So say if we went back to, say, pre-COVID, for instance, you know, when, you know, people were raising, the industry was raising, say, 3, 4, 5 billion, you know, the whole year. One thing venture capitalists will have you do is spend money. Venture capitalists, VCs, don't want you to keep money in a bank. They can keep money in the bank. That's not where they're giving it to you. Always remember that. So the VC is going to be biased to get you to spend. So because they want to fund growth, and they want you to spend so that you get to the next round with more growth, get more capital in. They do better on paper at the very least, and they can go maybe raise a new fund, or they can on paper say that they've appreciated the value of the funds that they've spent. So venture capitalists generally will ask you to just spend. Now, that's changing, of course, because of the current climate, but that's the default setting for them. But that's not always in the interest of the business. That's not always in the interest of the founder. Now, of course, we know there's a bit of ego, there's a little bit of status seeking that goes on. We're humans, and so when you raise $2 million, $3 million, you want to be in front of TechCrunch and say, oh, look at me, I'm amazing, I'm great. You want to, as some people say on Twitter, go to South and be spending some cash on baddies. So those things, they play a role. But I mean, the role as a founder is to know why you're doing things and be, I would say, more prudent and say, okay, yes, I've raised $2 million. what do I want to achieve within the next, say, 18 months with this $2 million? And be very wise in the way you spend that and be very analytical. Your marketing budget should definitely be looking at the CAC, so cost of acquiring customers versus the lifetime value of that customer. And if you're not tracking, if you're tracking that and you see that, oh, your CAC is going up and your LTV is coming down, then maybe it's time to switch this thing around. Sometimes people aren't analytical enough. They just spend on billboards, spend on digital ads. They keep going, and they don't realize that they are actually, say, spending $100 on customers that will only end them $5.
Yeah. Okay. So when you first raised venture capital for Wella Health, what was your experience and what surprised you about the entire process?
I wasn't prepared for how long it would take and how difficult it would be. You read TechCrunch, I say, everybody's like raising millions. This must be so easy. If there's one thing anybody listening to this and take away, is that raising VC is very difficult. It will take you a long, long time to do it. And so don't take those TechCrunch reports as, everybody's doing it, I can do it as well. I mean, yes, you can do it, but it's not going to be easy. So I was surprised that it took the time that it did and that it was as hard as it, you know, as it turned out to be. So yeah, raising VC is very difficult.
How long did it take you to raise and how much did you raise?
So I've raised across a number of rounds. So I would say that on average for each round, it's probably taking the best part of 6 months to a year to raise. And each time you're kind of always, I'm a believer in the idea of always be raising. We are in a market where there isn't that much venture capital. People don't really understand it.
Yeah.
And so whenever somebody is willing to have a conversation and willing to cut a check, you should be open to that. And so I'm always raising. I never say no. If investor wants to have a chat, I often will jump on that chat. Now, there are peaks, of course. There are times where I do it exclusively and focus and say, have, 20, 30, 40 conversations when we go. But I'm literally always talking to somebody. So it's nonstop. You're always raising. In my experience, anyway, in this market that we're in, you're always raising and always speaking to investors.
I think that's really solid advice because I've seen a lot of founders who claim that, they were able to close their rounds in 6-7 weeks. And sometimes I wonder if I was a founder and I see someone who said he was able to close a round in 6 or 7 weeks, and it's taking me maybe 4 or 5 months to just get someone to maybe even take a look at my deck.
Exactly.
You could get discouraged. That's when right. You see stories like that. So I think that perspective is important. It could take you up to a year to raise a round. So yeah, thanks for putting that out there. So moving on, a lot of founders talk about Africa needing patient capital. What does that mean for you? What is patient capital in the African context?
So patient capital is really important, right? What that means is that you got to be so impatient for returns, but impatient for progress. And the reason for that is that we are doing very foundational stuff. A lot of us are building infrastructure, and it takes time to build infrastructure. I would say that perhaps the industry where there isn't as much infrastructural deficit is actually in fintech. And that's why you're seeing fintech raise a lot of money. That's why you see Paystack can go from first check-in to exit of $200 million within 5 years. But that's not because of Paystack. That's because there was an infrastructure that they could build upon. So yes, they did great work, but they had infrastructure to build upon. If you cycle back a few years, when InterSwitch started off, InterSwitch took about 4 years to even just network everybody and get started, right? And then Paystack can come and build upon a lot of that knowledge and know-how and expertise in the industry to be able to make that progress. So the reason why we need patient capital is because a lot of us are building infrastructure. Now, I work with healthcare providers, right? When I started, I wanted to plug into an API that would connect me to healthcare providers. Guess what? It didn't exist. Right. So now if I was building my business in the US, those APIs already exist. In Nigeria, I had to personally walk into healthcare providers myself and convince people to even come on board. I've not even spoken of building tech. I've not built tech yet. I have to go into hundreds of people and convince them that me, Neto, I'm a real person. You can trust me. I'll not run away. You understand what I mean? Right? Yeah. Again, it's a low trust society. That's the first step. Before you even talk of code, XUI, the first step is get on the street, get in people's offices, say, CEO, I'm here, flesh and blood. I'm real. I'm not going to run away. I'm going to build this thing and, we'll be here for you. So that is why we need patient capital. Because there's no, you cannot leapfrog that one. You can't. So even say people use LeapFrog for say mobile networks, they still had to build physical infrastructure, and that took time. Base stations take time, and you now have base stations that need generators, have diesel, so there's significant ongoing OPEX for even that infrastructure. So that's the reason for the patient capital, is that this infrastructure hasn't been built, we have to build it, and there's no other way to do it.
Okay, so that ties into my next question. You've mentioned that infrastructural deficit is a major reason why Africa needs patient capital. And you work in the health tech space where very little capital is coming when we benchmark it with, say, fintech and maybe lately climate tech. What would you say, apart from the lack of infrastructure, is responsible for the low amount of funding that health tech startups tend to get?
Yes, so that's a good question. So I would say that there isn't enough understanding. So I would say that a lot of the investors are generic investors. They don't really understand healthcare. And the challenge with that is, if I go to a generic investor to start to describe, oh, there's primary healthcare, there's secondary healthcare, there's tertiary healthcare, you know, there are all these types of providers, there's this, there's that, you know, people can get very lost. And so there aren't enough specialized healthcare investors that understand healthcare. And so because of that, they see, oh, it's too much regulation, or it's too risky, or it's too difficult. And so people aren't really interested. And because of that, there's a bit of a gap, knowledge gap, for you to be confident and comfortable in investing in healthcare. Because honestly, I've spoken to some investors that have just given plain bad advice. And investors like to think they know it all. I'm here to tell anybody listening that, you know, investors don't know anything, you know.
My last guest mentioned that.
At best, they know how to build a financial model, you know, and raise money from LPs. But most investors don't know how to run a business. They haven't run a successful business before. They've not sold anything before. I think sometimes we overvalue the advice that investors give. I can tell you for free that most investors have no idea what they're talking about, especially in our markets. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are some that do, you know, and you can name them on one hand, but most of them have no idea what they're talking about. And so it's the job of the entrepreneur to go figure that out, and to hopefully bring the investors along. Now, over time, this will change. Like if you go to the US, for instance, they have very savvy investors. Because a lot of times those investors have been operators themselves, or they've even been regulators, or they've been in academia. They've done a lot of work to really understand the ecosystem. I think we're still early on. Yeah. So we're building a lot of the capacity, the knowledge, the resource base, so that people can actually start to understand the markets that they're working in and invest in them more. The other thing that I think is that healthcare is very traditional, and healthcare, we're a bit of laggards. And so because of that, you have only very traditional people investing, and they only understand traditional models. So there's an established culture of PE in healthcare, of course, but PE in healthcare, they don't want to build an app. They don't want to do digital stuff because that's not what they know and understand. They want to build physical infrastructure. They want to buy drugs. You know, that is the business they get. And so there's a little bit of a mismatch. But that's changing. I think over time, there'll be more alignment and people will be able to understand the industry more. There'll be more returns. I think the next 10 years, you're going to have one or two big exits. And then once that happens, you know, see more money is going to be crowding in.
Okay, so when you say healthcare is traditional, could it be because you're literally dealing with human lives? So you make one mistake, it could lead to the death of a whole lot of people. Exactly. If my app malfunctions as a fintech founder for a day, the worst that could happen is that someone doesn't get paid his salary or something like that, which can always be rectified. It's not exactly a life-threatening situation. So is that the reason?
Exactly, yes. So a lot of people criticize healthcare. Our healthcare is too slow, it's too traditional. Well, it's a feature, it's not a bug. Healthcare is supposed to be slow, it's supposed to be traditional, because you're right. If we're going to make a change, we should ensure that it's safe, it is sustainable, it'll be there forever. You know, today you see 10 fintech apps, tomorrow you see 10 new fintech apps, the 10 fintech apps from yesterday are all gone. Nobody bats an eyelid.
Yeah.
You can't do that in healthcare, you know what I mean? You just can't come today and go tomorrow. You know, you can't do that. And so it can be problematic, but I think that it's important that healthcare is traditional, that it is rigorous, that we do take some time to adopt things, and that, you know, people actually prove that they will be there for the long haul. And that saves, that helps to protect patients, helps to save the cost and actually make things in the long term better. In the short term, yes, it is difficult, but I think in the long term, it is important that healthcare is traditional. And funny enough, this is not just for digital technology. So If you go to the US, there's only one industry that still uses fax machines in the US, right? And that's healthcare. You understand? The reason is it works.
Yeah.
We've used it for years, and we're just going to keep using it. Yeah. And so healthcare is designed that way. It's frustrating, but I think there's good reason why that is. And yes, while we might change some things, I think we should also accept that it's also good that sometimes things remain the way they are.
Yeah, okay. So earlier you mentioned that a lot of investors in this part are not exactly knowledgeable about the sectors that they're investing in. And so it creates a knowledge gap that also affects how they invest. So how can a founder who, especially now that a lot of young people are just going out and starting businesses, the founder doesn't have a lot of domain knowledge or domain expertise in what they're building. And then they're going out to a VC who probably doesn't have as much domain knowledge in that sector. How can a founder balance that? Because the consensus is that an investor shouldn't just give you money. They should also be able to help with a lot of other things.
Yes, true. That's what, you know, an investor should be able to help with a lot of other things. But I can tell you again for free that most investors, they just don't, or they even can't. And I mean, they're also stretched. Because to be fair to investors, raising money for Africa is difficult. So they also have it difficult. So they're not going to come and help you solve your day-to-day problems because they have their own day-to-day problems. To your question about new and young founders going out to raise money without domain expertise, I would say that's a very bad idea, especially in Africa. I think it's important that you earn your stripes in the industry, that you understand the nuances so that the knowledge gap that we say is there isn't there. So I would say that try and work somewhere before you go try to start your own company or raise some money. It's not the US. I mean, in the US, Zuckerberg had lots of people that could just shepherd him through the whole process. Like you just go to Harvard, go to Stanford, they'll tell you how to build a company from start to finish, right? We don't have that capacity yet. So I think that the people starting companies should have some domain expertise. And perhaps the next generation, maybe the next two generations of founders can then rely on the expertise of the people that have gone before. Because now imagine like a Shola from Paystack being your investor or your mentor. Like you can skip through so many things. Or imagine GB, for instance, your supporter, you can skip through so many steps. So I would say that learn, understand the industry, gain some domain expertise before you try and come and start a company. Because otherwise, it would be very difficult.
Yeah. The ecosystem that founders depend on in order to succeed is very wide. It's not just investors or maybe fellow founders. There's also academia. And in Nigeria, there's this disconnect between academia and the business world. How can we ensure that tech startups in particular can benefit from the experience or the knowledge in academia?
Yes. So this one topic I'm super passionate about. When I spend time in the US, I meet people who they started out as founders. Then they ended up in academia. Then they went into investing side and then they're back as founders. So there's a nice loop of where people can go around sharing a lot of insights, understanding and networks. So everything is very connected. And again, we know in Silicon Valley, Stanford is at the heart of that. A lot of things go through there. Google was founded in Stanford. A lot of AI research is funded in universities. A lot of the PhDs that are going into industry are coming from the university. So, and they're all publishing. So it's very interconnected network in the advanced ecosystems like you have in Silicon Valley. In Nigeria, that's really non-existent. And I think that is probably because of the type of innovation that we are working on. So a lot of the technology innovation that is happening is not happening in Nigeria. We're basically just bringing existing technology and trying to use business model innovation to actually further whatever goals or solve whatever problems we have. And so I think that maybe the disconnect is that the types of academics that we need are actually business academics, right? So not so much engineering or technical, but it's more business schools, marketing departments. Those are the types of academics we need. And I don't know that the academics we have in those kind of business schools and marketing departments in Nigeria are attuned to what is going on in technology space. So I don't know who's to lead this. I think maybe on both sides, and perhaps the government can also help. Because, I mean, realistically, we cannot remove ourselves from the broader context of the poor funding of our universities, of the poor skills that the researchers and university professors have. Because if they were better funded or if the industry was responsible for funding them, then perhaps they would be coming out more to say, how can I help you in the industry? What research can I do? How can we work together? Can we have a residential period? I mean, this happens a lot in the US. People actually go from the academia and take up residence in companies. I mean, Clayton Christensen, that's where he got a lot of his ideas to write his book on innovation, is you leave academia and you go actually stay in a company for a decent amount of time, have access to the data. We don't like sharing data, but have access to the data and all of that. So there's a lot of stuff that needs to be done, and hopefully it gets done over time.
Okay, so I recently came across an article you wrote, I think sometime in 2021, about the gender funding gap in the healthcare space. And your argument was that it's not as bad in healthcare as it is in other sectors, because the gender balance is quite fair in healthcare. So can you expand more on that?
Oh, yes. You know, I mean, people talk about the gender gap in funding, which is true. And if you look in Africa, very true. I think it's less than 3% go to female founded teams. But if you break that down a little bit more, again, I'm a fan of breaking things down. And on my Twitter bio, it says the devil is in the data, right? If you break it down a little bit more, what you realize is that the bulk of the funding goes to fintech. And who are the people that are founding fintech companies? It's people that have financial experience, right? And who are the people that have financial experience? Well, they're men. You go to your average bank, who is working there on the product side or the engineering side, or in the side where you would potentially go on to start a company, it's mostly men. So if you're going to fund fintech the most, invariably you're going to fund men. That's just the way it is. Now, if you come to healthcare, where the gender split is a bit more even, in fact, there's more women in healthcare than men, of course, if you fund, just close your eyes and fund a healthcare company, you're more likely to hit a woman. You're just more likely to hit a woman. And I try to make that point that the industries that the genders are naturally, you can argue nature or not, but the industries where you have a preponderance of a certain gender, the more you fund that industry, that would then tell you the type of founders you have in the end. And then also, of course, there needs to be a broader closing of the gap in education. So again, talking about local Nigerian markets, not as many women go to schools, or not as many girls go to schools as men do. So more girls need to go to school, of course. And then when you get that, you then need to fund industries where women are just going to. So it's things like education, things like healthcare. And then if that happens, you'll find that actually a lot of the funding gap will be closed. Now, of course, you know, if women want to start a fintech, of course they should go and they should be funded. But I would say if you step back and just look at the raw numbers, if you're going to be funding male-dominated fields, then of course you're going to have more male-funded founders. And if you're going to be funding female-dominated fields, you're going to have more female-funded founders.
Yeah, okay. My final question would be, as a founder who also doubles as an angel investor, what would you ask for from the investor community?
I think we've answered already. Patient capital. You know? And again, I mean, I understand why. So I've come to understand the game. They say don't hate the player, hate the game. Or in fact, I would say don't even hate the game. My own philosophy is don't hate the game. The game is the game. You cannot change the game. Understand the rules of the game and understand where you can play.
And play it.
That's it, yeah. Right? And the game is rigged, it's fixed. You're never going to fix it. And that's not your job, I don't think, especially if you're a small fish. If you're a big fish, if you're government, or if you have billions of dollars, you can fix it. But all of us that are small fish, let's understand the rules of the game and then play accordingly. So if I had a wish, I would say patient capital and people that understand the nuances of our market a little bit more. But the reality, of course, is that that's difficult to come by. And so we just have to play the game and understand where we can make quick wins, where we can tell a story, who is the right person to go after for us. For instance, we do a lot of grants. We get grants from international foundations that help us just go a bit longer. So understand the rules of the game, try to play it. That's what I'm trying to do. And then when you're in a position where you can change the game, please try and change it for the people coming.
All right. So thank you so much for your time. This was a very insightful session. So thank you so much. And I am very sure our listeners would gain a lot of value from this.
Absolutely. Thanks. Always a pleasure.
That's it for this week's episode of Equity Majors. If you enjoyed this conversation, you should check out other episodes of the podcast with other interesting guests. Finally, you can share this podcast on your social media. It helps more people discover it. Thanks for tuning in and see you in the next one.